Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, we look at emotional health and why we should be paying attention to it. Joining us is psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and social worker Jenny Putnam. Good morning to you all.
Good morning, Emily.
Good morning.
So let's talk about emotional health versus mental health. What's the difference? What are we talking about?
Well, obviously, they're related. They both have emotional in it. But no, they don't, actually. Mental health, when we talk about mental health, we're talking about the diagnosable conditions that people treat, that professionals treat. So that we're talking about health. Emotional health is more along the lines of your day-to-day interactions with people, how you handle your emotions, how you manage them, how you express yourself, and how adaptive it is to your situation. Or do you make things worse by a very intelligent physician who got himself addicted, basically, and not to alcohol or drugs, but to work and to perfectionism, and how harmful that was for his life because he was very open about it. The thing that stimulated this topic was this book he wrote, which is a bestseller. It's called Outlive, O-U-T-L-I-V-E. And the name of the author is Dr. Peter Attia, A-T-T-I-A. A very interesting man. He's a physician, and he trained initially at Johns Hopkins in cardiac surgery. Basically finished, I think he finished his residency or not, which is a very long residency and grueling, but he became a cardiac surgeon. But as he started working in the field, he got frustrated because he was, he became he became a general surgeon, which meant oncology, which meant much of his work was around cancer. And removing tumors. Well, he became frustrated because he would remove a tumor, surgery would go one well, and the patient would get a couple more years of life, and then they would die. So he wasn't treating the disease, he was just removing a symptom of it. So he basically left medicine at that point and did some other things, including math and technology, which he's very adept at, started getting involved in what we call health span, the span of life that you can be healthy during. That's what medicine should be focused on, not diseases so much of, giving a pill, diagnosing, surgery, et cetera, but helping the person be healthy for a longer time. That's where medicine has deviated from its really true mission. He wrote this book called Outlive. It's been a bestseller. And much of it, when I read it, it was like going to medical school again because there was so much science in it.
Yeah, we should say the subtitle is The Science and Art of Longevity, right?
That's right.
And I think, Jonathan, you were the one to first pick up this book, I think, right? And were sort of impressed with it. And Peter Attia, here's this guy who appears to have it all, right? He's got this great career. He's got this beautiful family, wealth and fame. But the last chapter of his book, he talks about his own struggles very openly. And I thought this was interesting. Like when I first saw that he went into rehab, I mean, rehab, you automatically think it's alcohol or drugs. But as you said, Mark, that wasn't his issue. His issue was this addiction to work and perfection. And Jonathan, I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Well, I guess I do want to make the point to the listeners, to our listeners, that at least in my opinion, that the most kind of comprehensive, to make a long story short, I think what Dr. Attia really focuses on fundamentally, and we'll get to that last chapter in a minute, is the difference between what he calls medicine 2.0 and medicine 3.0. And I think that that's really important for people to hear because as a physician myself, I fully subscribe to what he's saying. And I feel like this is a message that the medical community and our society in general should have received a long time ago. So medicine 2.0, which Dr. Attia, experienced in his surgical residency, By the way, I think he actually quit after 6 out of the 8 years. But
Oh,
in any
goodness.
event, so we've gotten pretty good, as Dr. Attia says, at fixing problems which are the result, in most cases, of chronic processes. So, for example, we've gotten better and better at treating people for cancer. We've gotten better and better at treating people for cardiovascular disease. As we've come up with new medicines, new surgical procedures, new gizmos, and so on. What we haven't gotten good at all is helping people not get sick. So these are most of these processes, whether we're talking about dementia, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, or cancer, what he calls the four horsemen, these are, for the most part, well, they are the result of very long-term, chronic, smoldering, behind-the-scenes processes that most of us heap on ourselves through a constant stream of small doses of misbehavior or neglect of what we really need. And so then he goes on to talk about medicine 3.0, which is all the things that we can do to reduce the risk of getting these illnesses, rather than focusing on and depending upon our healthcare system, which, as we all know, is really in tatters, depending on our healthcare system to fix these problems once they've occurred. And that's really what the body of the book is about. As Mark said, in the very last chapter, he focuses on the emotional, mental side of things and reveals his own history. What's interesting, of course, is that he probably only became the compulsive, driven, obsessive, Superman achiever because of whatever his childhood traumas were. So I guess we can thank the
Partially
who.
because of that.
Yeah.
Lots of
What's
people
that?
have those. Partially because of that. Lots of people have those kinds of traumas and do not.
Well, of course. I mean,
Yeah.
clearly he's very, very bright. I mean, yeah, there's lots of this the nature and nurture discussion to be had. But and he's an extremely smart guy. I don't easily buy into anything I read, and I think that most 300-page books could easily have been written in 15 pages. But this is the exception to that rule, and he does cover a lot of an awful lot of territory. But I feel like I've lost the thread of what you asked me.
No, that was great. That was a great stuff. But yeah, go ahead, Jenny.
Can I add something? Because I also thought one of the things I found the most striking was that he said we can extend our lifespan by a little, not by a lot. Like there's an endpoint genetically for humans, it seems like, but that health span, so that instead of spending the last decade or two of your life sort of miserable and sick, you can spend the last couple decades of your life healthy and engaged in the world and then have a more precipitous
In the
sort of
longevity
fall
community,
before you die. So it's not like a long.
in the longevity community, the debate that still takes place today is the conversation that compares health span to lifespan. And again, medicine 2.0 has gotten quite good at increasing lifespan, but in a compromised state. Whereas health span is the whole idea of living as long as possible, as healthy as possible, to have to enjoy. In fact, I had a visit with my primary care doctor a couple of weeks ago, and I was telling him about this book, which he hadn't heard of, and talking to him about health span, and which I think he sort of looked at me kind of funny and said, "You really want to live as long as you can?" Like, as and I felt like we were about to have a political conversation about the current administration, but but the idea, I think all of us, I mean, none of us want to spend 15 years in a wheelchair. None of us want to spend 10 years having to only walk slowly because we've had four stents put into our cardiac arteries. All of us would like to be as healthy as possible, as long as possible. So this book, I think, is for people who are patient and are willing to read the same material maybe two or three times if needed, it really is a roadmap for how to be as healthy as you can.
One of the things I thought was interesting here too is, and we're going to talk focus more on the last chapter, which is the emotional health piece of it, was that here's this guy who's working on how to be healthy longer of your life, but he's miserable, right? And his friends are saying, well, why do you want to live so long if you're so miserable? So he doesn't really seek help until he's pretty much out of control, had some real like anger issues and it was his friends pointing it out, and a friend who was a psychiatrist who was like, you should go to rehab, right? I want to go back to
enough to have these really dedicated friends who really pushed him both times he went into rehab.
And one of the things that comes out in rehab is the childhood trauma he talks about, and he's reluctant at first to talk about anything, and that sort of, Jenny, reminded me of because you work a lot with people with trauma, right?
So Absolutely. That was most of what I did.
And there's been so much done recently, studies recently, on the impacts of childhood trauma. So not surprising that that can have a big impact on our adult selves, right?
Yeah, so one of the reasons I said it wasn't the only thing that pushed him to do that is because often I'm listening to us speaking with an ear to what my patients would say when they come into the office after hearing something like this. And I can just imagine people coming in and saying, oh my God, I was, you know, raped or beaten by my whatever caretaker, and I'm not a superstar, and using that as yet another cudgel to beat themselves up with. Mm-hmm. So I want to tread carefully. I loved this book. I really did. I thought it was really brilliant. But this guy is completely obsessive.
And
I also recommend reading the book. I think it was really great, really interesting science. But with a grain of salt, recognizing that most of us are not going to go to the extremes that he continues to do. Mm-hmm.
But
he's not a model that you don't necessarily want to follow like a piece of carbon paper. It would be instructive, I think, to talk just about how he came to start to use therapy in his first rehab place, where he resisted and resisted, cursing at the staff, I don't belong here.
Right.
Et cetera, et cetera. He either wouldn't talk in the meetings that they had. He dreaded the group meetings where he was supposed to talk about his quote unquote story. So he did one of the group meetings and he says, you know, I don't really need to be here. The therapist cuts him off and says something like, because he did mention that he had an injury or a trauma when he was about 5 years of age. He said, the therapist said, you were 5 years of old when this first happened to you. We don't know the details of exactly what it was, but it was probably at least physical abuse and probably sexual abuse, but not by a relative. And so he agrees, yes, that's right. And then the therapist says, your son is almost 5 years of age now. So you're telling us now that it was okay what happened to you at 5 years of age, because he dismissed it as important, even though the details were now on the table. You dismissed it, but would you be okay with people doing that to your five-year-old son now? Well, he had to get Kleenex. Mm-hmm. He broke down. And that's when he started pouring out his trauma, which really is the psychological root of his compulsiveness, his addiction to control, you know, having to control things. As a surgeon, he couldn't control the people dying, so he left the field. So we want to get across to the audience today, I think, is just how early experiences, especially trauma, can shape a life. Mm-hmm. Certainly he had a lot of good achievements over the course of his life. And well recognized, et cetera. But he was, like we said before, he was miserable, and he hurt his own family.
Right.
There was one incident. Go ahead.
Are you going to talk about the baby almost dying?
That one
blew my mind. So the baby is what, about a month old, I think. It stops breathing. Yeah. His wife is a nurse. She's does CPR. They get the baby in the ambulance. He's in New York. She calls him to say, hey, we're on the way to the hospital. The baby almost died. And this is very unusual, I guess, to save this baby this young. And he says, call me when you get there. I want to talk to the doctors. He doesn't come home for 10 days. Stays in New York for his business. I would have been all over for me right there. But I'm like, wow. But he's constantly in touch with the doctors, you know, wanting to know what's going on.
He's doing the hands-off routine, emotionally.
Yeah.
I think that Peter Attia would probably be the very first person to say that he shouldn't be the model for anybody who's reading his book or listening to his podcast. Yeah. He does now run a medical group called Early Medical. And that's interesting. And I assume that the reason his medical group is called Early Medical is because they really do focus largely on prevention and on tackling early risk factors. He himself, by the way, it's interesting to know that he himself has a very rich family history of early deaths from cardiovascular disease. And he kind of stumbled on that. And despite the fact that this guy has swam twice from Catalina Island to the coast of California. And still, when he got out of the water the second time, looked at himself and thought that he was kind of overweight. So that gives you an idea of how. I wouldn't trade places with. I've said, just based on reading part of his book, I think he'd be very tough to have as a friend, at least early on in his life.
He's intense, very intense. Yeah,
very, very intense, very driven. And his podcast is called The Drive, and I would certainly recommend that to people as well.
Yeah.
No. I want to go back to something real quick, Mindy, because I think it's important. Mm-hmm. So he talks about women's depression showing up more and men's depression showing up as anger more often. And he talks about something that I certainly observed and talked about in my practice, which is women have a hard time with anger, mm-hmm. which brings them into therapy, so that's fine. But men have a hard time with shame, and so they so they very often avoid therapy because shame is something that is intolerable for many men. Yeah. And so I just want that message out there to men that shame is something that we're here to hold with you as well.
Right. And sadness too, right, Jenny? I mean, sadness, men also.
Well, because sadness makes them feel shame because they're supposed to feel manly.
Mm-hmm.
They're vulnerable.
Yeah,
vulnerable.
We got to take a break, but after the break, I want to talk about this early prevention of trauma. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address: thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about emotional health this morning and a book, Outlive, The Science and Art of Longevity, written by Dr. Peter Attia, who talks about his own struggles with emotional health in the book. With us is psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and social worker Jenny Putnam. Going back to that idea of the childhood trauma having impact on our adult lives, there's different types of trauma, and the same trauma two people can experience may impact them completely differently. So, you know, if you and your sibling have some sort of trauma, you know, with whatever parent that's, you know, neglectful, let's say, one sibling may really suffer from that trauma and another may not, right? And the different types of trauma impact people differently. So it's very complex.
Oh, yes. And it has to do with the brain. The brain is very complex, exceedingly so. There's no one path that people travel when they've had some kind of trauma, and sometimes trauma is, we think of it, if at least it's not overwhelming, then it helps the person be resilient. There's a delicate balance here, but this man was clearly overwhelmed by his trauma.
Yeah.
I think that there's a difference also. I mean, he makes a distinction, which I think is great, between trauma and adversity.
Mm-hmm. So that's the difference.
Yes.
I would argue that two children in a household who both experience trauma are both traumatized, but might deal with it differently. And this goes back to the question of emotional health versus mental health that I think we all know people who were the heroes in their family, where they maybe raised the other kids or took care of their parents or whatever, and they seem like the ones who haven't been traumatized. Nurses often are these people. I love nurses,
So do I.
but it takes a real toll on those people. And so eventually, firefighters are another example. They end up in an office feeling like they've just completely crumbled because they've held it together for so long, and finally they've reached that tipping point. So I just want to be really careful about saying that just because you don't have these overt signs of mental illness doesn't mean that you can't shore up some of your emotional supports.
Sure.
And the early intervention part, I mentioned to you before we went on the air, some terrible news that the program Calmer Choice, which is a prevention-based emotional behavior, a well-being program that was in the public schools, they decided last week to suspend this program. They're doing away with the program. It's a lot to do with funding. They're
Terrible.
closing operations. I guess they'll continue through June through the school year, but they made that difficult decision, I guess, of the board
I think
last
we
week.
should
It's
all donate to
terrible.
them, try and get them back
Get
in
them
there
back.
because.
So important. I mean, and what they were teaching these young kids is, mindfulness, but also what are these emotions I'm feeling and how do I deal with them? And Jenny, they have the wise old owl and the guard dog, and kids go, oh, that's what's happening, right? So,
It's so good on so many levels, both because so first of all, as I was saying earlier before we were on air, it's so much harder to learn these things when you're older. You have so many other things that you need to be focusing on, and so it's very hard to slow down and learn this stuff, as you get older. And so those programs in the schools, especially for kids who don't have that, are
right.
so valuable. And then I love the owl and the dog because it's parts work. It's saying you aren't just the dog, you aren't just the owl. You are a composite of all these parts that you have, and they're all important, but they are more appropriate in some situations than others. And so you start learning how to use those different parts of yourself. So much better to be taught when you're young.
Right.
It breaks my heart.
Yeah, to be able to be mindful about your emotions and learn and observe your emotions. It's best when you're younger, and then you continue practicing it. And if you don't get very good at it, then you become a psychotherapist, as like us. Because we see the value of being able to describe in words what the experience is. That structures it. And if you remember our talk, a few weeks ago about schizophrenia, the difference between Neanderthals and human beings is speech. And that's what enabled humans to get to the to have the success on this planet that Neanderthals could never have, or pre-humans couldn't have. But because we had speech, we could develop concepts and communicate. That's what is responsible for our dominance, really. So in a way, a psychotherapist is talking to an individual about becoming civilized in a way, using what your brain is capable of, which is observation and mindfulness. That's the value. So people talk about talk therapy as if it's not valuable. It's incredibly valuable, many times more important than medication when we're dealing with mental health as opposed to emotional well-being.
So one of the things we see, we talked about Dr. Attia goes into rehab and he's reluctant. He finally has this little bit of a breakthrough and he starts to talk, but he still leaves early, right? He still leaves earlier than people wanted him to.
From the rehab, that's
Yes,
right.
from the
Yes.
rehab. So he still has a lot of work to do at that point,
A
right?
lot of work to
Yeah,
do, right?
yeah. And then he does eventually go back to a second rehab.
Right. Yeah. I'd say one more week longer, actually.
The point he makes that I think is really important, and I think it's okay that he left early because he had done the work he was able to do at that time. I think we need to give people a break. He never gives himself a break, but I would absolutely give him a break for that. He did a lot of work. The work, especially with that level of trauma that he had, is painful. It's painful. It's like you have to break your leg to reset it, right? It's not a fun process, but at the other side of it, it's so much better. But you don't want to break every leg in your body all at the same time. You want to pace it out a little bit.
One of the things that he talks about in his process is reframing the situation,
right?
Or getting a different perspective, which I thought was really interesting because that's something we all can do very easily, right? And he gives the example of, you know, his wife comes home from grocery shopping and, you know, he's not helping her with the groceries. And because he's thinking, well, I just worked all day. I'm the one bringing home the money. And then he stops to think of it from his wife's point of view, who picked up the boys and, you know, brings them to the grocery store. And they're probably fighting with each other and all of the sort of, you know, chaos that she's coming from. And he says, I should have helped her with the groceries. That's just like putting yourself in the other person's shoes. Right.
That's right. And that can diffuse and many, many arguments, unnecessary arguments. Because you see it from the other person's view. That's a critical, I mean, we should have learned it in kindergarten. Mm-hmm. If we did, it didn't stick with us. And that really has an impact on emotional health later on.
One of the things that I think is interesting, particularly in light of what you were saying, Mindy, about the cancellation or the suspension of this program in the schools, is that most of what, you know, Peter Attia writes about and talks about is how you can reduce your risk of the four horsemen, the cancer, the cardiovascular disease, and so on, by living in a healthy way from as early in life as possible. But, and although he does focus in that last chapter on his own journey for treatment and emotional and mental rehabilitation, I don't know that he spends a lot of time talking about how we could think about emotional long-term health in a preventative way. So the program that you were just referring to of teaching children mindfulness, and by the way, we should get Dr. John Kabat-Zinn, who after all does a summer in Woods Hole.
Yeah, he's been on before.
Yeah, I know. And we should get him to get involved in resuscitating this program, because wouldn't that be great for him to get involved with this famous guy? But anyway, so I think that, one of the points that I think I'd like to make to our listeners is that in the same way that you can reduce your risk of cardiovascular disease or cancer by not smoking, by not drinking excessively, by exercising regularly, and so on and so forth, we can also reduce the risk of depression, of anxiety disorders, and all these other kind of mental health issues that weigh people down, by also teaching kids as best we can how to tackle anxieties or upsets or reasons for anger early on in life, rather than suppressing them or repressing them or acting them out in a violent way, et cetera. You know, I mean, that's in terms of prevention, that's something we also aren't really great at. I'm so sorry to hear about this program being suspended.
So am I, yeah. I'm sure I can just see some parents going, well, how do I do that, right? I mean, and I think, conversation, Mark, as you mentioned, talking, like, I know I have conversations with my grandson all the time, like something he perceives as a bullying situation. And I go, okay, let's look at that. What do you think is going on with that kid who said whatever he said? You know, is maybe he's jealous. Maybe he's maybe his own life. He's got anger, things are happening. I try to get him to look at the same thing, different perspectives, you know, and he'll just say, no, he's just mean, you know. but having those conversations, and same thing with anxiety, because it seems to me like, I don't remember, and maybe we just didn't talk about it as much. I don't remember young kids having the anxiety that they have today, but of course the world's a different place as well. But the little things that they get anxious about, it's like, you know, how do you help kids through those situations? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I think that we grew up in a time of especially low anxiety. The people I see in my practice here on Aging Cape Cod or SAW were often, one generation, the children of people who were in World War II. And so that was a big disruptor, and there was a lot of anxiety around that. And I actually remember being anxious still when I was a kid about the bomb dropping, or truthfully about Nazis. I was afraid of Nazis as well, but I was a little bit of an anxious kid. But in general, I think the world actually is as anxiety provoking as bullies. Mm-hmm. So what I'm hearing now from colleagues in New York who work with a younger population is people in their 20s and even 30s coming in and saying, what is the point? What is the point of me living? What is the point of me going on when the world is going to end? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, it's so dire. It feels so dire to people right now.
Yeah.
Or I just got out of a period of spending way too much time on my phone. And I'm super educated about that stuff, so I know that that's making me anxious. And I have all these skills that I've learned through being in the, you know, field for 25 years. It's so hard to do those things, but I think we have to think about not just anxiety of bullies, but anxieties of the world. Yeah. And okay, so to answer your question though, Mindy, it's just back to breathing and exercising. Yeah. It's all the things that Dr. Adia talks about: exercise, mindfulness, eating right mm-hmm. makes a big difference. I hate to tell people this, but too much sugar is really bad for your nervous system.
Sleep, getting enough sleep.
Sleep, yeah. Yep. Those same old things that people are always saying. There's not enough that any of the four of us can say about how you need to eat right, exercise, get enough sleep, and breathe.
Right.
Breathe. Right. Stay in the now. Stay right here, right now, grounded.
Yeah. Also, too, I think, you know, we had Thor Hansen on yesterday talking about being out in nature. Being out in nature. It's like, yeah. Get away from, like, the news of the day, no matter what your age, right? Is, you know, go outside, take a walk on the beach, or, you know, in the woods, what have
Don't
you.
Don't listen to a podcast while you're doing it or anything. Just, you know.
Listen to the birds.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
But is it okay if I'm on TikTok while I'm taking a nature walk?
No. No, put that phone away.
You know, it's fine. I feel very fortunate because I live right on an estuary and we've got these huge windows in our home, and I literally sit in my living room and I'm looking out the window and I am very conscious of feeling calm.
Right.
And I feel like, God, I'm so lucky to be, I literally don't even have to step outside in order to feel that I'm in nature. It's really cool. But
everywhere, you know, a shot of light through a window can be beautiful.
Right. Yeah.
Sorry, Jonathan. I didn't mean to interrupt.
You're bumming me out now. Now I'm getting angry. I'm getting angry.
Sorry. Just breathe, Jonathan. Just breathe.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about emotional health this morning with psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and social worker Jenny Putnam. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We're also talking about the book Outlive, The Science and Art of Longevity by Dr. Peter Attia. Jenny, do you want to say something? You had your hand.
No, okay. It's gone. It was some piece that he did that I thought was brilliant, and now it's like forgetting it. Thank
It'll come back, though. All right. So one of the other things that he mentions in the book, which I thought was interesting, is this focus on eulogy virtues versus resume virtues. Mark, talk about that.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. It was on my tongue, too. he was driven to perform and actually, well, actually to control his environment, to control the world, essentially. But what he produced in life was a wonderful resume, all sorts of awards, publications, writing things, and that's what he produced. And so he's thinking that he went to a funeral and they were talking about, they were giving a eulogy to the person who died. They didn't mention anything about this. Instead, they talked about what kind of person he was, how connected he was, how loving he was, how dedicated and available he was. Basically the kind of person that we would all want as a parent or a neighbor. So those are the eulogy virtues. And he paid no attention to developing a good eulogy resume. He developed a good professional one, and he was addicted to that. So it made him miserable. So the type A people out there should pay attention to this, that really what matters in life is what they're going to say about you after you die. If you want to put it, if we want to make it simple. And it's going to be about what kind of person you are, and not what you achieved necessarily.
I would say it also, doesn't it make for a better life once you retire? A lot of people retire and they really struggle with that, who they were in their professional life. And if you've spent your whole professional life really focused just on what we call those, resume virtues, you might not be as happy in the retirement years if you haven't worked on any of those, what they call eulogy virtues. Yeah,
exactly. You know, I've seen a number of people, especially on the Cape, people who had been CEOs or chiefs, decision makers.
And it does become harder and harder to form deep friendships the older you get. Mm-hmm. I've seen, people become more and more set in their ways. And so it just becomes harder.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's easier to reconnect with people that you haven't interacted with in a long time, and they become more important. I found that those older relationships really are meaningful.
Yeah, I would say, and don't be afraid to reach out to some of those older relationships, because it's amazing how you can reach back to a friend you haven't seen in 20 years, and it's like you pick up right where you left off. That's when you know you got a good friend, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And Jenny, you had said something before we went on the air that I thought was interesting. We were talking about childhood trauma, and you said when they have a feeling of helplessness.
And Nadia mentions this. So what I find over and over again when parents ask me what they can do to protect their kids. So like people right now are afraid of their children being kidnapped or their children being, taken into sex rings. This is a terrifying reality. It's much more likely that your child is going to be harmed by a close friend or relative than by, a random person out in the community. But the people, the kids who I saw and the parents who I saw who brought their kids in after some horrible event happened, the kids were almost always fine because the parents were taking care of it, had listened to the kids and were taking action. So the kids did not feel helpless. Mm-hmm. And the adults I had who were survivors of childhood abuse, sexual or otherwise, the primary thing was they went to their mom or dad and their mom or dad did not protect them. And so, it's this feeling that you have no control over the world. It's the same thing I was saying about the 20 and 30 year olds who are in the offices of my friends now. You have no control over the world. And so my advice to those 20 and 30 year olds is to make changes that you can make, become involved in local things that you can actually have an impact on. And it's remarkable how much that builds resiliency, helping people it's that old, what is that serenity prayer? We all know this.
Give me the knowledge
and the
strength.
And
to
like
distinguish
the things I can change from the things I can't change.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a really, really good resiliency lesson for kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's hard because, you know, you have this tendency to want to protect your kids from all kinds of pain, right? But they have to, you know, you can't win every game. You can't, you know, you have to teach them to...
Adversity is good.
Yeah, adversity. And I think that's hard for some parents to do, right? But you're not doing them any favors if you don't.
It's so, the parents have to remember that often, not always, and I don't want to say always because sometimes parents disregard their children's emotions. And then again, you have that helplessness thing. But often for parents who are actually paying attention, it's more painful for the parents. So when you look at kids who have undergone cancer treatments, the kids are emotionally fine. The parents are a wreck because the parents were the ones who felt helpless.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, makes sense. One of the other things I was thinking too, you know, he talks about exercise and mindfulness, but just even back to that sort of reframing, even when we can't necessarily know why somebody, you know, is being grumpy to us on a particular day, kindness goes a long way. Just being kind, right? You know, just give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe they are just a jerk in real life, but it doesn't mean we have to be.
Yeah, I think I talked about this in a previous episode where I was driving down 28 in the summer, of course, notoriously jam-packed. And I let someone in to the traffic, and the guy behind me beeped really loudly, got really mad. And so I waved, and so he gave me the finger. And so then we drove a little further, and I let another person in. He almost lost his mind. And so I pulled over, and I let him go in front of me.
Yeah.
You know, neither of us going anywhere.
Right.
But it made him feel better that he didn't have to sit side behind. And I saw that he was a veteran of Afghan war. And I was like, oh, duh.
Yeah.
You know, of course.
Yeah.
His nervous system has been completely derailed.
Yeah. No, you're right.
Yeah. Got an email from Jan who says, there are recordings of birds on the internet. I searched for it after your program about birds. Thanks for the reading suggestion today. Jan, thanks for the note. That's true. I mean, a lot of people, there's all kinds of rainforest you can listen to. You can, I mean, all kinds of sounds if you find that relaxing, that you can just close your eyes and pretend you're in
pictures
the rainforest.
Of kittens and bunnies.
Yeah.
I have my alarm clock with bird sounds.
Do you?
Waking me up with bird sounds. It's good.
No, they even have a clock that, you know, strikes a different bird sound at the different hours.
Yeah.
So, all right. He also talks about COVID, and I think we can all relate to that, you know, because we were all kind of indoors, and I think a lot of people, going back to that discovering nature, rediscovered, if not, you know, discovered the benefits of just kind of taking a walk outside, or, you know, but yeah, that had a big impact on everybody. Everybody kind of forced to slow down.
It also is a great example of how everybody felt helpless.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right.
And so
the whole population, right?
The roof. Yeah.
All right, what else do we want to say about what Dr. Attia had to say that we should be paying attention to? I guess before we go there, we should mention one of the things that was interesting when he talked about trauma is he called them little T's and big T's, right? There's
right.
big trauma that, you know, but little traumas can add up to become like
I
a big trauma.
That term.
Did you?
I really hate it because I've heard it, you know, for years and a lot of people use it. I think it's starting to shift because the idea is that big T's are acute traumas. So like if you're in a car accident, that could be considered a big T, whereas a entire childhood of abuse and neglect is considered a little T.
Oh, I would say that's a big T.
It just feels wrong. Yeah. And so, you know, the idea is just that developmental trauma. So trauma that happened throughout while you were developing has been in the literature called little T, but it actually is much more damaging than a big T.
Yeah.
Repeated episodes of being helpless.
Yeah. That was going to be my point, is those little traumas can add up to be quite a big impact. And it's interesting how the body doesn't forget trauma. We've talked about this before. And you can be reliving, talking about something that happened to you many, many, many years ago. And all of a sudden you're like, you know, you feel your body reacting to it and you go, what's going on? The body doesn't forget, right?
Yeah, that's right. And that's one thing to point out, that we all have memories. And actually, overwhelming trauma is kind of stored a different way in the brain than memories of what happened yesterday. And there's no time stamp to them. They're not confined to an episode. And that's just the way it's recorded, so to speak. But you want to be aware of that, that trauma memories are different than regular memories. Mm. And the other thing about memories is memories are from the past. They're about the past, but they're not for the past. The way our brain is, memories are for the future to give you an idea of how to respond to what's going on today based on what had happened before. Mm-hmm. So if you look at it that way, trauma memories can dictate too much of how you see the world today, because those trauma memories feed into your automatic perception, unconscious, mm-hmm. but automatic perception of what's going on today.
I think we should also mention again, so that the listeners are aware of EMDR as a very potent type of treatment that can really be life-changing for people who are survivors of either big T's or little T's. There are a growing number of therapists on the Cape and in the South Coast region who have become skilled in using this technique to help people, the term that they use is to reprocess past events, but most importantly, to be able to kind of leave some of those trauma-related emotional problems behind and move on in a different way.
Yeah. I just want to add to that a couple things. So I think you should try and find a certified EMDR clinician if you have childhood trauma.
Non-GMO too.
Non-GMO certified.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And farm to table.
Because anybody who's been trained over a weekend can do what are considered big T, but I consider acute traumas. You know, if you're ever in a car accident, you can't get over it, something like that, go to anybody who says EMDR and it'll be miraculous. Mm-hmm. But if you have childhood trauma and someone says to you, you're too smart to do EMDR, or EMDR is not good for childhood trauma, find a different EMDR therapist. Yeah.
Good. That's good advice. All right. So just a couple minutes left. I want to know, has anybody changed their exercise or mindfulness stuff since reading the book? Jonathan, have you stepped it up a little bit?
Well, I have stepped it up. I mean, one of the things that people will learn if they read the book or listen to podcasts of Dr. Atiya or Rhonda Patrick is about the different zones. And anyway, the point is that people argue about what's better, you know, weight resistance training, weightlifting, as opposed to cardiovascular kind of aerobic training. The reality is that different types of exercise give you different benefits. Mm-hmm. And that's now been very well documented by cardiac physiology research. And the trick is to find a way to exercise that you will do
both,
that you won't find so boring. Yeah.
Yeah.
And to learn about how to, you know, take good care of your body.
Yeah. All right. Psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and social worker Jenny Putnam, as always, thanks for being here. The book, again, for those who might not have caught it, is Outlive, The Science and Art of Longevity by Peter Attia. Thanks, as always, for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.